This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Francesc from Sourced.
Hi, how are you doing? I'm Francesc. I'm VP of Developer Relations and Product at Sourced.
What is Sourced?
Our tagline, if I remember correctly, is something like machine learning for large-scale code analysis. Basically, our idea is extracting information from source code. For many years, source code keeps on being more and more abundant. Everybody has source code. Software companies have source code, but companies that are not related to software at all, they do have a lot of software in there. What we're trying to do is, rather than just thinking about source code as that thing that you need to maintain in order to obtain software, we want to use it as a source of data. So we can extract insights and try to predict things based on the past that is actually part of the Git repository. And then on top of that, also, once you have a lot of data, well, machine learning, what we're trying to do is improve developer tooling, things like assisted code review, bug detection, bug prediction, through the usage of machine learning on source code.
I'd like to come back to some of that later from an enterprise perspective. You've released a report looking at Kubernetes. You've pulled all the code together and you've produced some interesting analysis. Do you want to give us a highlight of it?
We decided that it'd be an interesting idea to analyze large open source projects because they're really interesting and they're really large, and they kind of represent a little bit also what happens in large companies that do inner source. It's like many different contributors, and it's hard to track what's going on. What we did was simply start by, let's count how many commits do we have per month. Something quite simple. Our tool Sourced Engine allows you to do this with SQL. So basically, it is pretty simple to, once you start asking a question, you're going to get an answer that's going to drive you to a different question, and then you're going to get another one, etc. So that's how we created the whole presentation. We ended up analyzing all of the source code under github.com/Kubernetes. We provided that to Joe Beta and all the people in the community, and then they pointed out the fact that we're missing more code because Kubernetes is more than Kubernetes. So it's also github.com/Kubernetes-sigs-and-incubator. We analyzed all of that source code to generate the presentation that you got to see.
One of the things you said about that was a vast number of contributors, and then you said it's a mature project. Can you give us a bit more on both of those?
We've seen a great number of contributors. Some of those contributors have contributed are actually very loyal contributors, if you wish. They've been there for quite a while. They've been contributing to many different parts of the project, etc. But we also do see many, many people that come and contribute like me. Only once. My contribution to Kubernetes was actually fixing a typo in the documentation. These are also contributors. So that's why you see a really wide variety of contributors out there. Some of them are going to be like Tim Hawking, Joe Beta, like the people that were there from the beginning, and you see that the biggest number of commits come from them. But you also see lots of different people that have contributed maybe a little bit, or they started with a little bit and they've been evolving over time. That said, the interesting thing that we saw is that the speed of commits, or rather the number of commits per month, it's actually in decline. We saw that in the Kubernetes project, in the Kubernetes core project, the number of commits, which is a proxy for the amount of effort people are putting in the project, kind of stabilized between 2016 and 2017. And in 2018, it actually went down.
Now, that's quite surprising, because if we look at where we are with Kubernetes, we are just beginning to apply security. We are moving out of that test, dev, play phase and moving into production. We're not a mature production environment. And if we're seeing a slowdown at the moment, what does that imply for the next couple of years as we see more and more companies suddenly come in?
That is actually really interesting, because once I saw that, my first reaction was verifying that my SQL request was indeed correct, because it felt very weird to me that it's slowing down. But then we started looking at everything that is going around the core project. And that's when we started seeing things like Test Infra, which is a different project from Kubernetes, but it's a project that powers the way we test Kubernetes. That has a huge amount of contributions. You have also the website has a huge amount of contributions. But even with all of those, under github.com/Kubernetes, the number of commits was declining. And then was when we shared this with Joe Beta, also Chris Nova. They pointed out that indeed we're missing two more pieces of the puzzle. And once you add those, actually you see that the effort has moved from the core to many other special interest groups. Some of those special interest groups are actually interested on security. Some other are interested in AWS or Google Cloud Platform. The interesting thing is that this is actually a very good indication that the effort put at the beginning of the project in very stable APIs has paid off. Because now the contributions, even though they're really important, do not need to be part of the core project. So if you're using AWS, you can actually use that project AWS specific one where you can plug easily to Kubernetes. But if you're not using it, then you don't need to use it. This, when you take into account the complexity of the project, is actually really important, because the more code you have, the more bugs you have. No matter how good you are at writing code, you will have bugs. So by limiting the amount of code you need to run Kubernetes, we're actually making Kubernetes more secure.
You were looking at the core Kubernetes code. We have 79 distributions out there. We know that many of those distributions will add a little bit here, a little bit there, just to make them more attractive to developers. Yeah. If we're currently now reviewing that core code and hardening that code and looking at side projects, how easy do you think it will be for all those distributions to continually update themselves? And more importantly, how easy will it be for customers to trust 79 different distributions?
That's a good question. I do not see it that differently to Linux itself. Linux has many distributions, and whenever you have a contribution to the kernel, you need to wait to have it everywhere around. But it works well, and it works well because Linux has a very well-defined architecture. And I feel like Kubernetes has successfully defined a very clear architecture, so that will not necessarily be an issue, but it definitely depends on those maintainers of the distributions on actually proactively updating everything, making sure that whenever there's a serious bug, like recently there was one, that before there's a fix, that everybody in the team is aware, so that fix will be applied as soon as possible and released to everyone. So I do not think it's a new problem, to be honest. I think it's pretty similar to whatever would happen in the Linux community.
You mentioned APIs there. One of the things we've been doing for the last 3 years is trying to make people do everything through an API. The problem with APIs is that they change over time. People don't necessarily track how they change. They don't see elements in an API as a trackable object in their manifest for their code. As we start to go through this phase of being mature and then linking out and becoming the core container control point, there's going to have to be greater integration with other projects. How important is it going to be that they get control of the APIs? The APIs are hardened and very, very visible.
That is a really, really good point. Kubernetes has a very clear API when it comes from the REST API being what others use. But when you're integrating into the project, say you're creating an operator, a controller, you're actually using the API, which is the API from the Go code. That one is not as well documented, I would say, and it's incredibly large. That is something that I was a little bit worried. We did an analysis with Source Engine. You can also analyze not only the metadata, but also the code. So we found all of the things that were exported that people could depend on the Kubernetes project. On version 1.0, there was something around 4,000 methods. By version 1.7, there was something around 16,000. That's a pretty serious explosion. Luckily, since then, that was at the beginning of 2017, it's pretty stable. That shows that sign of maturity, but also conscience of knowing that, okay, we cannot keep on bringing more and more complexity to the project. The API nowadays is actually pretty stable, which is good, which also leads to the fact that there's more effort on documenting that API correctly. And any API, if you have it for long enough and there's an effort on testing it, eventually it will be safer. I'm not going to say safe, I'm going to say safer. So I do believe that the fact that you can see on one side more contributions going into test infra and all of these things that allow us to make sure that Kubernetes has higher quality, plus the fact that the Kubernetes code base nowadays is pretty stable, means that we're actually removing defects quite effectively. Eventually, all of those APIs will be stable enough that most of the activity will be actually built at higher levels of the system. Nowadays, yeah, we're working on controllers, we're working on operators. Maybe after that, there's going to be something that is going to be based on top of those concepts. And then all of a sudden, you just forget about the Kubernetes layer and just like basically the really low level, and everybody just assume it's there.
The phrase you use in your report is mature. And if there's one thing we've learned in this industry, when something becomes mature, we get less eyeballs on it. We tend to assume it's done. As every commercial vendor will tell you, that's when it comes back and bites you in the bottom. We know that things we think today are safe to do, in 5-10 years' time, may turn out to be a complete disaster, because there'll be new vulnerabilities, new things that have come with the libraries we've relied on that we didn't know at the time. How important is it going to be for Kubernetes to maintain the level of code inspection to ensure it doesn't fall into the same trap as happens with a lot of commercial software?
I agree that it is a problem because Kubernetes has a pretty good process, meaning that whenever you want to contribute some code, there's a lot of eyes on that code. But it is true that once the code is there, the number of eyes that you get is smaller. So if you're changing things that are below that level, dependencies to that code, maybe you're actually breaking that code. I do think that the effort put on all the testing infrastructure is going to pay off for that, because if there's a new dependency upgraded and that breaks something, we'll be able to see it. But it's true that there's a lot of code. It is almost 2 million lines of code, and having eyeballs on all of those is going to be really hard. That's actually why things like what we're working on the machine learning things to predict or to detect bugs, it's going to be really powerful. There's some examples from Microsoft Research, for instance. They were able to write something quite simple where basically you train a model to, given a program that is missing one token, one word, predict what is the missing word. It's called varmizus, that's a problem. And they use that to try and find bugs on the .NET codebase, which is mature, we could say. And they actually found hundreds of them. In the future, the eyeballs problem is not going to be that much of a problem because we're going to be able to have digital eyeballs.
Now, with open source, we've got eyeballs, and we're going to have virtual eyeballs. With curated source, commercial products, we hope that the vendors will be around long enough to actually spot their errors and will continue to give us large blocks of patches every single day of our lives. But the truth is, 80 to 90% of code in an enterprise is written by the enterprise it sits inside. We're moving into an age where low-code, no-code environments are being pushed very heavily, and that's code that's not going to be built, created, and done by the IT department. We're trying to push this to the edge, to end users, in the same way as we've done with macros since the late 1980s, early 1990s. When we look at what you've done here, what lessons are there for enterprises to be taking on what you've done and now applying that to their code base? Because they are in a war and they are losing this battle.
The biggest thing is, with these kind of tools, you're going to be able to have visibility on what's going on in your code base, which is the first step. Because if you don't know what's going on, you cannot improve it. For large companies, especially the ones trying to go through migrations, specific processes like, let's say, adopting InnerSource or trying to go cloud native, there's so many things that you need to take into account that you cannot just hope for the best. Hope is not a strategy. I think that is the motto of SREs at Google. Hope is not a strategy or something like that. The idea here is to say, you're going to be able to write down some of the technical guidelines, some of the things that you care about, say, InnerSource. What I want is people from different teams to collaborate together successfully. Sure, write it down as a SQL query. Say, what is the amount of people that collaborate from different teams, and see how that evolves. And then try to impact that by doing some programs. You actually have a metric that you can impact on. So that is very useful for some of these things. For more technical guidelines, you can kind of do the same. So you could say, you shouldn't be using Angular 1.0 anymore because Angular 2 is much better. Sure. You could actually write a quick query that just tells you how, in what places you're using Angular 1, and then just have a burn down chart, and you can see how those things start going away little by little, which is great. But also, you can have on the other side, on the assisted code review part, something that tells you whenever anyone tries to bring new code that breaks that technical guideline, to warn you and say, no, that should not be done.
But you're talking now about writing queries and interpreting those queries, which is a challenge for a lot of organizations. They don't have the manpower. How do you shift what you're doing to a more fundamental level? So maybe just having it in one of the platforms out there, one of the Cloud Foundry distributions, or having it inside OpenShift, so that it's completely invisible to the developer. It's invisible to a lot of people, but actually in the background, it's gathering data, it's learning data, it's discovering, it's making suggestions forward. How far away are you from being able to have that conversation about how do we get embedded into the platform?
That's a complicated question to answer. The problem is companies do not like to share their code. Even if it's aggregation of data on the issues they have, the kind of software they use, it's actually really delicate to get. But following the same philosophy of what you were mentioning, I think that this is why things like serverless or even Kubernetes are a thing, rather than having companies writing all of their stack. Instead, they're going to be able to integrate with well-known open source projects, say Kubernetes, that has this kind of analysis where you know that the security and the quality are assured and that there's an effort on that. And then writing as little code as you can, because at the end of the day, if you're writing code, there's going to be bugs. So that's why things like serverless have a huge value for companies, not only because it's easier to write, but because you write less code.
But if we think about it from a platform perspective, there's no need for companies to share code, is there? Let's take IBM as a good example here. I'm developing on the IBM platform. I can go and get IBM's Cloud Foundry dedicated. I can go and get IBM's Cloud Foundry open. There's four versions of IBM's Cloud Foundry sitting out there. There's nothing to stop Susti being embedded inside that platform. IBM can then curate those rules and actually can deliver a set of best practice rules forward if it chooses to. And the same is true of anybody running any of the platform as a services. That actually then delivers that to all these developers coming in. More importantly, it means that as I bring new developers on, I know automatically what they do is going to be captured in the platform and delivered to me. There's no leakage here unless I choose to share. And all I need to share is anonymous data about things.
I definitely agree that's super interesting. There's things like, for instance, we've done this analysis for Kubernetes, is could we provide kind of the same template, kind of the same visibility to all the projects in the Cloud Native Computing Foundation? If anyone from the Cloud Native Computing Foundation is listening, yes, let's talk. And once you do that, yeah, indeed, you could even create some specific analyzers that are related to, say, Kubernetes. So if you're building on top of Kubernetes, you're going to be able to run Source Engine or Source Lookout, which is the assisted code review, and get specific things that do not make any sense for anyone else, but for you, because you're running on Kubernetes, these metrics are going to be meaningful to you. It's actually really similar, you think about it, about observability in general, running in production. You have Kubernetes, and yeah, of course, you also have other projects around Kubernetes that are specifically done for them. Service mesh or monitoring all of these projects. Maybe Source should be a Cloud Native Computing Foundation project, which provides visibility not over the runtime, but rather on the source code.
It goes wider than that then, because not only does it sit inside a platform, but as an enterprise could take this on themselves without going through a platform. They could then choose to share some statistics back if they wanted, but it allows your community to start to develop new rules, new queries that somebody can import. This breaks what we have at the moment, and what we have at the moment is a lot of very expensive code examination tools that are complicated to use and are rarely used in a wide sense. And it seems to me that you have an opportunity to step into a gap that the market needs.
Definitely, we're interested in that. Something else that goes hand in hand with this is the fact that we are developing models with machine learning that what they try to do is trying to understand what is the evolution of source code and trying to predict, given a piece of code, what is the next change that is going to happen. This normally happens for two different reasons. One is there's defects, and the other one that occurs pretty often is there's upgrades to dependencies. Once you have a large enough code base, say Kubernetes, and you see that in Kubernetes, whenever someone writes that code, after a little bit changes to something else. That same pattern could be applied to code that is not open source, that is running your company, and we're going to be able to detect the same kind of things and say, hey, Kubernetes doesn't do it. Probably you don't want to do it either. All of these things where we're able to, it's a technical term, but transfer knowledge from one large community to a smaller one, that should be really successful. Yeah.
If we look back at the history of how we've tried to improve development, we've tried looking across all of our projects. We've tried looking back in time. And in both of those efforts, we were trying to identify common failure points. Was a component used multiple times that turned out to have a failure? Was an individual developer involved in a project where they kept making the same mistake? What do we need to do to correct this to improve our code quality? If you have that ability to do that analysis through the machine learning and then predict the risk and the value, when we talk about shift left, this is a massive shift left. It means before I even start, I have an expectation of saying, yeah, this is the number of hours that may well have to be devoted to remediation before I've even begun my project.
It totally makes sense, and you're giving me ideas, so I'm taking notes here.
It sounds like you're going to have a busy year ahead of you.
Oh, yes.
Francesc, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.